everyone, and welcome back to the CGA podcast. Today I have Bryson Katona, MD, PhD. He is a gastroenterologist at the University of Penn, and he is the director of the GI program there. Also accompanying him is Dr. Susan McFarland, MD. She is a pediatric oncologist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, widely known by CHOP. Thank you both for coming on the podcast today.
Happy to be here, TJ. Thanks for the invitation. I'm a huge fan of the CGA podcast series and really excited to record this one today.
And today we brought you on because we wanted to talk about your recent article that was published in Cancer Prevention Research in 2020 in October, the phenotypic differences in juvenile polyposis syndrome with or without a disease-causing SMAD4 or BMPR1A variant. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this research, and I think we can just start first and foremost with what led to the whole concept of this article.
Great. So the concept of this article actually came from a lot of conversations that Suzanne and I and other colleagues of ours had been having at our weekly cancer genetics case conference that we have at University of Pennsylvania and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. It's funny how sometimes these informal conversations can actually lead to productive research projects down the road. We had been discussing a lot that for our JPS patients, we felt that we were really seeing very different types of patients. So on the adult side, we felt like we were seeing a very different type of or group of JPS patients than Suzanne and her colleagues were seeing on the pediatric side. And it really seemed as though we were seeing more JPS mutation carriers with a SMAD4 or a BMPR1A mutation, whereas on the pediatric side, it seemed they were seeing almost more JPS patients without a identifiable genetic mutation. And of course, as you know, with JPS, as far as polyposis syndromes go, in JPS, people have always done more lumping as opposed to splitting. And so half of JPS patients have identifiable mutation in SMAD4 or BMPR1A, but then you have the other half that meet clinical criteria for JPS, but they have no identifiable mutation. But ultimately, all these patients get kind of lumped into the same diagnosis of JPS, and management is fairly similar. So it seemed that amongst our conversations that we were seeing very distinct subsets of JPS populations in the adult versus the pediatric population. And so based on those differences we were seeing, we really delved into the literature to look at this. And it turned out that most of the JPS studies that are out there really are focused on JPS due to a documented germline variant, or in other studies, genetic testing wasn't done. And so we realized that there weren't really any good resources exploring this group of individuals with JPS without a genetic mutation. And so that really is kind of a long-winded answer to what got us involved in this project.
Well, you know, you're in a specialty center when you can even make the distinction between different classifications of JPS patients with or without mutations. So what were the major goals of the article?
Yeah, so in this article, we really were seeking to compare individuals who met clinical criteria for juvenile polyposis syndrome, who did or did not have a pathogenic or likely pathogenic variant in SMAD4 or BMPR1A. And so we sort of lumped those into two categories as those with or without a disease-causing variant, just to make it a little easier to say in the article. And we really wanted to better understand the burden of disease in the group without a variant compared to those with a variant. So we looked at things like polyp burden over time, the age of onset of disease, whether or not they had a family history, location of polyps, whether it was upper or lower GI, and then whether they needed certain procedures, colectomy or gastrectomy, and then whether they had a history of cancer, specifically of GI cancer related to their disease.
How did you go about getting the data to answer the study questions?
We first looked at the data that we had from our institution. And I think that between Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and ourselves at Penn, we had a pretty substantial number of individuals with JPS. But as with many of these rare diseases, we didn't think we had enough between the two centers to get the meaningful associations that we wanted to get at. And so in order to really attack this the right way, we knew that this was going to have to be a multi-center effort. And since JPS spans the pediatric to the adult spectrum, we knew that we were going to need both pediatric and adult centers to participate, especially given the anecdotal differences that Suzanne and I were seeing between the experiences of our own centers. So based on that, we really embarked on first getting this collaborative effort together to get the appropriate information. And funny thing, very CGA specific thing, is that I started discussing with all the participating adult centers actually at a CGA meeting, at the San Diego meeting. That was about 2 years ago or so. So these meetings really are good starting points to getting these collaborative studies like this off the ground. But we were really fortunate to put together some fantastic collaborators. We ultimately had 9 different sites participate. So in addition to Penn and CHOP, we had 2 other children's hospitals. We had Lurie Children's in Chicago and Texas Children's as well. And then from the adult side, we had a University of Pittsburgh and Yale, and Sloan Kettering, and Dana-Farber, and then University of Wisconsin. So amongst these centers, we had just a lot of CGA members involved, which was really fantastic to work with so many great CGA colleagues on this collaborative effort.
Yeah, I see that impressive authorship. So Dr. McFarland, what were the major findings in the article?
Yeah, so the major findings, we really did see some pretty significant phenotypic differences between the group of patients with and without a disease-causing variant. We found that the individuals without a disease-causing variant and SMAD4 BNPR1A were diagnosed at a younger age. They had a lower likelihood of having a family history of disease, a lower chance of needing a colectomy as they got older. Additionally, none of them had upper gastrointestinal polyps, gastric or duodenal. And we also noticed that the lower intestinal polyp burden decreased after the first decade of life in this cohort, as opposed to the cohort of patients with a disease-causing variant who seemed to have a pretty steady polyp burden as they got older. Our study wasn't powered to show a statistical significance here, but given that our disease-causing variant negative cohort was younger, but we did see a trend towards fewer adult complications in this group, including a much lower rate of cancer. And then we were also able to kind of support some previous findings of other articles looking at a subgroup analysis of the SMAD4 and BNPR1A disease-causing variant individuals. And we found that those with a SMAD4 variant were more likely to have a family history of disease and were more likely to require a gastrectomy, which is not surprising given what's already been published in the field about the increased upper intestinal polyp burden in those individuals.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hoping the major impact of this article will be?
Yes, thanks. That's a great question, TJ. You know, in terms of major impact, I think one of the main things that we're hoping this article will do will be increasing recognition that individuals with mutation negative JPS, so JPS without a SMAD4 BMPR1A variant, likely do have a very distinctly different phenotype than those with a mutation. Mm-hmm. And by different phenotype, we're talking about different polyp distribution, differing timeline for development of polyps, ultimately likely differing cancer risks. To be honest, it's almost like the mutation negative group is almost an entirely different type of polyposis syndrome compared to those with a germline mutation. And I think that's an important point to emphasize, but I think it's also really brings up the interesting point of what is causing this mutation negative JPS. Is this an extension of sporadic juvenile polyps, dramatic extension of it, or maybe there's something else going on, maybe a low penetrance autosomal dominant variant? Maybe there's a rare autosomal recessive variant, mosaicism, epigenetic changes. I mean, the list goes on and on, but certainly makes you think there could be a distinct etiology here.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about, particularly mosaicism, if you think that might be confounding some of these cases.
Certainly a possibility. And Suzanne, I don't know if you want to comment a little bit about on that, as this is one of Suzanne's bread and butter areas.
So yeah, Dr. Katona brings up a really good point that's helped to inform some of our own analysis. We've been doing some germline sequencing of these patients, and it's really helped us to rethink how we're approaching this as not necessarily an autosomal dominant disease as it is in patients with a SMAD4 BMPR1A variant. So it's inspired us to go forward with some more intensive somatic sequencing and really to look at things like polyp tissue, colon tissue, sort of different samples from the same patient to really understand if there could be some underlying mosaicism in these patients without a germline variant.
Yeah, I'll be really excited to see how all that work plays out, Suzanne, because it's a really very interesting area. But TJ, just getting back to your original question, one other area where I think I'm really hoping that this article makes an impact is how we manage these individuals and actually maybe a push towards a more genotype-specific management plan for individuals with JPS. Based on the data from this paper, it seems likely that for individuals without a SMAD4 or BMPR1A mutation, it's likely possible that these individuals could have relaxing of their colonoscopic surveillance intervals over time and definitely begs the question of whether or not upper GI surveillance is even necessary in these individuals. In the mutation negative group, we didn't see any upper GI polyps amongst all the individuals we analyzed. If you look at other cancer genetic syndrome guidelines, I think people are doing more splitting now rather than lumping. So you take Lynch syndrome, for example. Everybody with Lynch syndrome used to be managed under the same recommendations, but now in recent guidelines, especially those from the NCCN, people are splitting Lynch syndrome up into different management recommendations with differing management recommendations for the high penetrance mutations versus differing management recommendations for the low penetrance ones. So I don't think it's unreasonable for JPS guidelines to do the same. And so, you know, maybe you have a separate set of guidelines for individuals with a SMAD4 or BMPR1A mutation, and then another set for those without a detectable mutation. And hopefully our paper will ultimately provide some additional evidence to help make that a reality mm-hmm. down the road.
Were there any challenges to finalizing the data?
So we were really lucky in having some wonderful collaborators who were incredibly responsive in gathering data. I think with any kind of collaboration that's multi-institutional and involves some retrospective chart review, there's going to be some challenges. I think especially in the different ways that different institutions would track things like polyp burden. Every EMR has its own way of tracking colonoscopies, and tracking polyp number by year and by decade could be quite challenging. That said, we were able to come up with a system that worked really well and was still statistically sound. And we also had, as I said, a very responsive group of collaborators who were able to requery their data as needed, provide answers as we got questions from reviewers. So I think that we're able to overcome those challenges with some good teamwork.
Yeah, that's great. And it allowed you to get a good group of over 100 people with JPS. So that's fantastic. Is there anything that you would cut out of the article or add if you could?
Nothing that I would cut out. I think with a question like this, there's always stuff we would love to have been able to add. You know, I think one of the main areas that I wish we had more information on, and I'm excited to learn more about down the road, is really the longer-term follow-up of these JPS patients that, that did not have a gene mutation. As Suzanne mentioned earlier, overall this cohort, which was much younger within our comparison compared to those with a SMAD4 or BMPR1A mutation, but it really is going to be very interesting to see how this group does longitudinally, to see, do they continue to not display any upper GI polyps, and just to follow whether or not their colonic polyp burden continues to decrease over time. So I think that's one area where I wish we had more data. And just to highlight a point that Suzanne made, another area I think that would have been nicer would be to have a little bit more granular data with regard to the specific type of polyps. Yeah. So for all the GIs who may be listening, when you remove 7 polyps and just label it as multiple small polyps, it makes reconciliation of this data really tough on the back end.
Yeah, GIs like to split the polyps. Everybody else likes to lump them.
Yeah, I say that jokingly, but having good, accurate polyp counts, especially for these syndromic patients, can be really helpful for these types of projects. You know, overall, I think those would be the two things I'd love to add. And people are going to be following these patients moving forward. And I think this is data, you know, we'll continue to collect over time.
What are you working on now in the field?
So right now, I think that Bryson made the excellent point that tracking these patients longitudinally over time is important. And so we've been making a big effort to get these patients enrolled in long-term biobanking and registry protocols. We'd really like to see what happens with them clinically over time, especially these variant negative patients. And then on the sort of more basic science side of things, my lab's also been trying to understand potential genetic underlying causes of disease in the patients who test negative for a variant. So we've been collecting germline and somatic samples of patients with and without a mutation and conducting sequencing and then modeling that in a colon organoid model to see if sort of better understand the pathogenesis of these polyps. And as Bryson alluded to, this clinical data has really informed the basic science work. It's been really helpful to think about these patients as now clinically as a separate presentation of disease. And that's really informed our analysis, especially of our recent whole genome sequencing data.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So are you trying to sequence the tumor itself too and compare it to germline?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're doing both. As much as possible, we're collecting samples of both polyp and adjacent normal colon when the patients undergo procedures. And we're really trying to do kind of all three, the normal colon, the somatic polyp sample, and then the germline together.
Yeah, great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, smart. Thank you both for coming on the podcast today. extremely informative. It's great to see a rare disease be moved along with this type of fantastic research, this multi-institutional. So hats off to you both and congratulations on the great publication.
Thanks so much, TJ. Really, really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very much for having us.